yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a-screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Today, we want to talk about a couple topics here. One is the preliminary release today of U.S. Gross Domestic Product, GDP, for the first quarter of this year, 2019. And I want to talk about what's going on with oil prices rising, and sanctions, and the consequences of that. And thirdly, about the return to currency instability here in the global economy and emerging market economies. What's behind that, particularly the growing crisis in Argentina as the tip of the spear, you might say, for emerging market currency instability. And then, as I promised last week in the second half of the show, I want to talk about neoliberalism, right? We all know about that phrase, that concept, thrown around a lot recent years, as a kind of way of describing what's been going on since Ronald Reagan and the economy in the 80s. I want to debunk that term a little bit, and explain my definition of it as it will be analyzed in my forthcoming book here later in the summer called The Scourge of Neoliberalism. Why another book on neoliberalism? There's plenty out there. Well, we'll talk about that in the second half of the show today. But first, let me return to these other topics, beginning with U.S. first quarter GDP came out. Okay, the GDP figure, the preliminary GDP, because there's three releases of the GDP. The first is preliminary, and it's usually the one that gets changed the most because the data is incomplete. And of course, we had this problem here of the government shutdown, and that makes the data even more incomplete. I think in the second revision for U.S. GDP, we're going to see a potentially significant change. And then the third revision that comes 4 or 5 months down the road is just sort of a cleanup. Few changes, typically, in that. So it's the second revision, a report on GDP, which is important. But we're going to look at the first one here today. And I want to bring some attention to the fact that the first quarter estimated GDP is 3.2% U.S. growth. Well, I don't believe it's 3.2%. I'll explain why. And even if it were, you've got to look beneath the surface to see what's really going on in that assumption of 3.2%. First of all, the first critique, and, you know, I've been teaching macroeconomics for quite some time, and one of the topics I really focus on is how reliable is the GDP number? It's imperfect and increasingly imperfect, but it's the only number that we really have for data. Well, I won't say the only number, but it's the number that's most often used to give some kind of a snapshot, you might say, of how well the economy is doing. But there's a lot of problems with it. I won't go into the limits of GDP. Others have done that quite a bit here. Stiglitz and so forth have all produced very succinct critiques of the limits of GDP. But we'll go with the number, all right? Well, first of all, you got to understand that 3.2% is what's called real GDP, meaning adjusted for inflation. You see, GDP is the total accounting of all goods and services produced in the U.S. and sold. Produced and sold. Okay, so if you say sold, they have a price. And if the goods sold have an increasing inflation, price increase, it's going to misrepresent how fast the economy really is growing, because that, you know, goods times the price will overinflate it. So what's called nominal GDP, in other words, all the goods and services produced and sold, is usually adjusted for the inflation rate to get the real increase in goods and services in the time period, in this case, first quarter. Okay, nominal GDP was 5.1%, which means that at 3.2% real GDP, the assumption is inflation was only growing 1.9%. And what they do for GDP inflation, they use a price index called the GDP deflator. Right. This is not the consumer price index, which is a different price index. And it's not the personal consumption expenditure price index, which is a third price index, which the Federal Reserve uses. It's a different price index altogether called the GDP deflator. It's the most conservative. And at 1.9%, it really underestimates the real inflation that's going on. I've been saying for quite some time that all these price indices underestimate inflation. Well, why do they do that? Well, you know, there's a motivation here, because if you underestimate the inflation, you get a higher real GDP. The 5.1 nominal, how much of that is inflationary? Price increases and not real growth of the economy is the question. Well, if it's only 1.9% inflation, we get the 3.2% real GDP growth. But if you estimated inflation more accurately, you would have a higher inflation rate than 1.9, and therefore you would get a lower real GDP. Okay. So GDP deflator 1.9, I think, is too low for reasons I'm not going to get into here. It gets very technical and arcane on assumptions that are built into these price estimations. The government, Federal Reserve PCE, was even lower, 1.3%, which kind of implies a slowing of the real economy. You know, when prices slow, like the 1.3% PCE, and probably the CPI is about the same or maybe even lower, it means that there's not much growth going on, real growth, but yet we see significant real growth. Well, there's a mismatch here between the inflation numbers and the real economy. I think that lies, in part at least, in the fact that these indices, these three official indices, especially the GDP deflator, are underestimating real inflation, therefore overestimating GDP growth. Okay, so that's one way of looking at this 3.2%. But let's start crunching the numbers a little bit here and look at what's embedded or behind the 3.2%. Let's accept the 3.2% real GDP for analysis purposes here. Okay, so what drove the 3.2%? Inventory buildups. The inventory buildup significantly contributed. What do we mean inventory buildup? We mean businesses producing things that they can't sell and they stuff in their warehouses. That's what inventory buildup is, excess inventories. And usually when you have excess inventories, it's an indication that business is overestimating what consumers and buyers are actually going to purchase in the coming period ahead, quarters and months ahead. In other words, they build up their inventories thinking that, the price of producing it, these goods is going to be higher, so let's build it up now and sell it at the higher price at the lower cost because we've already paid lower for it and make more profit. So they build up inventories typically before a recession. Always happens. And we have significant inventory buildup here. It may also be that we have the inventory buildup, I think it was like $128 billion in the quarter, because the borrowing costs are very low. So business says, well, let's borrow, let's expand, put it in our warehouses. And therefore, you get more borrowing, more debt. Well, I think the fact that the Fed said no more rate increases here in early January, and all the indications are that they're going to lower rates by the end of the year, is an incentive to business to borrow more, to produce more, to stuff it in their inventories at a lower production cost in anticipation of selling later. So it means that the Fed policies probably are partly responsible for producing these excess inventories going on. And of course, the low Fed rates now that aren't rising have stimulated corporate borrowing. You know, corporate debt has doubled from around $5 trillion to almost $10 trillion now during the post-2010 quote recovery, right? It's been a debt-driven recovery for business and for consumers and for government. We're just loading up on debt everywhere. We've talked about that, in other shows. But it's really been expressed in a boom in what's called junk debt and leveraged loans, which is junk loans, right? Those two financial markets have really accelerated in the wake of the Fed's announcement in early January. Junk debt came to a absolute standstill in the fourth quarter of last year. First time ever, nothing was being issued in terms of corporate junk debt. Now it's on a big boom, right? Big acceleration. Same with leveraged loans. This is ominous for the future, because more junk debt means more junk servicing instability when a crisis and a recession hits. So it's building up the potential for a financial problem in the non-banking sector, the corporate non-banking sector. Okay, so excess inventories are reflected in this excess debt accumulation and due to federal rate declines, and always a signal of business misestimating recessions. Okay, so that's the biggest part of this 3.2%. If you took out the excess inventories, you would not have a 3.2%. You'd have a 2.5% increase in GDP in the first quarter, notwithstanding the excess underestimation of inflation, which let's say conservatively would reduce it to about 2%. Okay, so, but that's not the only factor. If you look closely at the 3.2% first quarter GDP, it's also due to the trade deficit. Trade deficit had hit record levels here of, I think it was $800 billion annual at the end of last year. Well, what contributes to GDP as well as inventories and business spending, consumption, and government spending is what's called net exports. And this is where you see the trade deficit. So that you could reduce your trade deficit by increasing your exports, which would reflect a increase in production and real GDP in the U.S., or you could increase your net exports contribution to GDP by reducing your imports. Okay, well, you know, we got the trade war going on, and we've been reducing imports now in the first quarter, which was easy to do because you had this, you know, historic run-up in the deficit in 2018. So some improvement there in the net exports trade deficit also adds to GDP. So it's just a sort of a accounting thing, you might say, on the trade side that has something to do with GDP increase in the first quarter of this year. Actually, imports were down 3.7% and exports up 3.7%, but because they have different weights in terms of net exports total, what we got was a plus boost to GDP because of the shifting trade deficit. It doesn't mean that we produce more and sold more exports. All it means is we've purchased fewer imports because of this temporary trade war thing, which, by the way, is coming to an end here with China very soon. As I've been predicting for quite some time, there will be a deal, probably, you know, within weeks, but we'll have a show on that as well. Okay, so the 3.2% is boosted by inflation. Underestimation is boosted by inventory accumulation excesses, which are temporary and will be turned negative, the rest of the year, and by a temporary shift in the trade deficit. What's more important to look in GDP is real growth. What about the sectors that really drive growth? That's real business investment in equipment and structures and so forth, and consumption, household consumption. Real investment is about 10% of GDP. Real consumption, somewhere around 2/3 to 70%, so that's 80% of GDP. The rest of GDP is due to this net exports trade thing and government spending. Well, obviously, the most important elements of GDP are business investment and household consumption. So what's really happening there with household consumption in the first quarter? Well, it grew only 1.2% annual rate, 1.2%. In other words, the consumers did not add to this 3.2%. What about business investment? Well, structures, meaning residential housing and commercial property structures, was down 0.8%. So structures are declining. Housing is declining at a minus 2.8%. Equipment was actually flat at 0.2%. Okay, so in other words, flat to negative in real business investment. The only part of business investment that really showed some growth was intellectual property and software, which is just a, particularly IP, is a phony way of estimating business spending and GDP, which was introduced in 2013 to boost GDP. I've talked about that before. It's the least reliable, intellectual property valuation estimations of business investment. The real core of business investment is equipment and structures. And then, of course, inventories are part of that. Well, inventories went up, but housing is way down. Structures are down, and equipment is flat. That does not look to me like long-term business investment contributing in the first quarter or in the future quarters to GDP. You can look at this in relationship to Trump tax cuts. Trump promised that his multi-trillion dollar tax cuts that came into effect in January 2018 would boost business spending and investment 30% in 2018. Well, what did it do? Well, it started out about 8% growth rate in the first quarter of last year, but had declined to less than 3% at the end of the year. So as these tax cuts began taking effect, were they stimulating investment and therefore real investment and real jobs? No, they weren't. It was a slowing rate, and it's pretty much dissipated because now the rate for real investment in the first quarter of 2019 is only 2.7%. So consumption is growing annually at 1.2%. Real investment is growing annually at only 2.7%, and that's boosted by IP. So what we've got in the first quarter is roughly 80% of the economy flat. 80% is flat. Real investment, typically 10% of the economy, growing at less than 3%, despite trillions of dollars of tax cuts. And consumption, household consumption, growing at only 1.2%. Durables, which is the subset of household consumption, durable goods, actually declined 5.3%. Autos are falling through the floor. Services are growing more slowly. So we get only a 1.2% growth in consumption, annual rate, that's annualized, in the first quarter this year. And we get a real real investment growth of less than 3%, 2.7%, which is probably closer to 2% if you take away the fluff from IP estimations, intellectual property estimations. So the real drivers of the economy are not driving it. What about government spending? Well, that's driving the GDP to some extent because defense spending in the first quarter is up 4.1%. In short, to summarize, what you got in this 3.2% is excess inventory buildup that's going to be reversed here very soon, and you got a one-off temporary trade deficit contribution that's because of less imports, not more exports, and you got government war spending. That's behind the 3.2%. The real drivers of GDP, real investment, are hardly growing, and consumption hardly growing in the first quarter. And then, of course, the inflation overestimates the GDP. If you took away the one-offs here for inventory buildup and deficit imports, GDP is really growing 1 to 1.5%. Now, that's nothing. That's nothing, and it's below its historic average, and it's an indication that the economy fundamentally, you know, at its foundation, is growing slower and slower. And the big question is now whether Trump's sitting on the Federal Reserve and Jerome Powell here and getting the Fed to lower interest rates again before the end of the year so that the economy will pick up, hopefully, they think, by 2020 election year. You know, whether the Fed will lower rates, how much, how soon, and whether that will do something to housing and structures, building structures and equipment investment. That's the big play, one of the big plays that Trump is betting on. Right, because the tax cuts clearly, although you know trillions were directed to business investors and corporations and so forth, has had a temporary minimal effect on real investment, and that's declining rapidly. It's probably already played itself out. You know, it takes. Took trillions, hundreds of billions just last year in tax cuts. I think the corporate tax revenues are down $300 billion, right? It took hundreds of billions of dollars, a mountain of tax cuts for business and corporations and professional investors to produce a weak real economic effect. Weak. What we've got is inventory buildup, usually a harbinger of a recession, and we got a trade deficit shift that's a consequence of trade wars that will dissipate very quickly. Right? And what we got is real investment, real consumption, and non-defense spending down 5.9%, by the way, I should have said. Defense spending up 4.1, non-defense down 5.9. All right. what we got are the real drivers flat, and very temporary one-off kinds of growth in inventories and net exports deficit driving GDP with an underestimation, rather, of inflation. That's the picture, right? Going forward, there will be slower inventory buildup, for sure. All the indications are that consumption, particularly big-ticket items like autos and so forth, are going to continue to slow for the rest of the year. And indications of real investment, particularly in housing and structures, continuing to be very weak, and probably a reversing and a return to a higher trade deficit once the deal with China is over. Okay, that's my picture of the economy. The second topic is what's going on with oil prices? Oil prices are booming, right? Global oil prices, why? Well, after a 40% decline in prices in the second half of 2018, now they're going back up rapidly, which, by the way, will have an effect on consumption as well in the U.S. Well, it's primarily because of sanctions and speculation. Trump's sanctions targeting countries that produce oil. The sanctions have been for some time on Russia. Of course, they're intensifying. We just about cut off all oil sales for poor Venezuela, except to the extent that China or Russia will buy from them, and an intensification of the sanctions on Iran. What this has done is reduce the supply of available global crude oil. And, of course, if you reduce the supply, it tends to raise the price to some extent. Of course, the actual supply numbers have not been reduced that much yet, but oil prices are driven by global speculators on the futures market. That's why you can see such fluctuations over the period of a few months in the price of oil so significantly. The real supply and demand does not change that rapidly. It's the speculators who drive it up or drive it down. They make money in both directions. They drove it down last year, and now they're driving it up this year and making speculative profits in both directions. But underlying it are the justifications for the speculation, which are longer term, but nonetheless, the sanctions. You know, the U.S. has turned to the use of sanctions here as a tool increasingly in recent years. You know, it used to be tariffs and it used to be negotiations of trade agreements and so forth, but it's using sanctions more and more as an economic weapon here on behalf of U.S. imperialist interests, global interests, sanctions and tariffs and everything else. We see this, of course, in the trade war with Trump and his tariffs. But at the same time, we don't have that much analysis and emphasis on U.S. empire using sanctions to increase its share of markets and increase its profitability for its overseas corporations, multinational corporations. Okay. Also, there's some indication that U.S. shale oil producers, who are now the biggest producers of oil in the world here, even more than Saudi Arabia or Russia, those are the big three, there appears to be some kind of a glut, excess of production of U.S. shale. Well, that's probably an indicator of slowing manufacturing and industrial demand in the U.S. For U.S.-produced shale oil. That coincides with the sanctions that reduce the supply, in other words, excess availability of supply here on the U.S. side will lower the price and so forth. So, you know, it's a push and pull between sanctions, and maybe the sanctions on oil are really designed to protect U.S. shale oil producers' growing market share globally. I don't underestimate that. that the Trump administration is acting on behalf of the oil industry here, right? But oil futures speculation is driving the price up, and that's having a negative impact on emerging market economies that don't produce oil. Since oil futures trading and trading in oil is done with U.S. dollars, you see, and if you have a rising price of oil, you're going to have speculators and investors wanting to buy oil in the spot market as an investment play. And therefore, since it's traded in dollars, what you got is a demand for dollars to finance the speculation in oil. All right, so demand for dollars drives up the U.S. dollar as a global currency. And if the U.S. dollar goes up, other currencies go down, particularly those that aren't oil producing. So in other words, rising oil prices and the U.S. dollar have an effect on currency instability in emerging market economies, which takes us to our next topic here, which is EME, emerging market economies, currency instability returning. Argentina is the tip of the spear of this. Argentina, Turkey, and a few others, Indonesia and others, a year ago, were being whacked by this rising dollar, which at the time was being driven by rising U.S. rates by the Federal Reserve. Now the dollar is being pushed up due to demand for oil, you see. So different factors would drive up the dollar. Last year it was interest rates by the Fed, and this year, of course, it's speculation in oil and so forth, right? This is all because of the dollar is the international currency, trading currency, and reserve currency. Dollar imperialism is a main weapon of U.S. imperial empire manipulation, you see, to maintain and strengthen its empire, weaken its adversaries, even its allies. The dollar is a tremendous weapon, you know, and 85% of all trade roughly is done with dollars. There are most of the rest with euros, maybe a little yen, and less than 1% with the Chinese yuan. You know, the talk about China's currency taking over the dollar is far from the fact. It's going to be a long time before that happens. And the dollar is the bulwark of U.S. Economic empire around the world. As long as that bulwark remains, the U.S. will have a tremendous weapon to whip recalcitrant allies into shape and to do a deep six on adversaries or economies and countries it doesn't like. Well, best example of that is Venezuela right now, and I've talked about that and written about that on my blog, jackrasmus.com, on financial imperialism. You know, it's a weapon of financial imperialism, the dollar, and manipulating the dollar and preventing countries from using the dollar, because most of the trade in the world, especially oil, is done in dollars. Well, you know, what does Venezuela trade? Oil. If you prevent Venezuela from getting dollars, well, then you're going to squeeze Venezuela. Well, I've talked about that in detail in previous shows. If you're interested, just skip back a couple of weeks and play that show once again. Well, you know, it's the rising dollar has an impact on, quote, friendly economies. And, of course, the Argentine economy and government there, Macri, his name is, the president there, is a buddy of U.S. imperialism. We helped put him in power there, just as we helped put Bolsonaro in power in Brazil, and just as we're trying desperately to knock Maduro in Venezuela out. And, of course, also now signs the U.S. neocons are targeting Nicaragua and even Cuba. This is all part of John Bolton's aggressive neocon foreign policy here, cleaning up Latin America, putting their buddies in place in Latin America. Well, even the buddies can't always shield their economies from what the U.S. does in terms of its currency and interest rates and other things. Well, the peso, the Argentine peso, is plummeting once again. Just so far in 2019, the currency has dropped 24%. It dropped precipitously last year and then stabilized briefly, and now it's declining rapidly again. In fact, one day here recently, it dropped 5% in one day, and it's going to continue to decline. Other emerging markets are continuing to be impacted, Turkey, Brazil, Indonesia. Their response has been to raise their interest rates to stabilize their currency. But, of course, raising interest rates domestically means that they're causing unemployment. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as their currency declines, their inflation rate rises because it means goods are more expensive to be imported. And these economies are relatively small compared to U.S., and they import almost most of their basic needs. They don't produce them domestically like the U.S. does mostly. And they have to import a lot. A good example is, again, is Venezuela. They import just about everything except oil. If their currency collapses, that means the cost of their imports escalates proportionally. And that means they either have to sell more of their exports to gain dollars, and they do that by lowering the price of the goods and so forth, or they simply print more money that they don't get from dollars. And that adds to inflation as well. Okay, so, big decline in the peso, inflation up. Inflation is running at a 55% annual rate here last month, which is double about the 25% in 2018. Unemployment is up over 9%, probably much more than that. Poverty rate over 30% in Argentina. Elections coming at the end of the year here, toward the second half, right? Macri, the president there, is blaming deficits and government spending on social programs. That's what they do, you see. They don't blame the cuts in business taxes that Macri has implemented since he came into power. They don't blame the increase in debt and loans and borrowing from foreign banks that Macri did, in which the rich skim off the top of that for themselves. They don't blame the rising interest rates to attract foreign capital or the stock speculators. Macri doesn't blame all of them for the deficit. He blames social programs for the deficit and spending on social programs and necessities of folks, right? So we're going to have a real interesting year for the Argentine economy, just as, of course, the economy and politics continue to boil in Brazil and in Venezuela and elsewhere in Latin America. All right, but there's a link here, isn't there, between global oil prices, currencies, and economic performance, and the dollar. All of these things are interrelated, and they have consequences, even stretching back to rising interest rates and rising dollar value, for whatever cause, in the United States. This reverberates everywhere around the world in different ways. Okay. Which brings us to, why does it reverberate? What's all this about? Well, some people say this is all part of what's called the neoliberal revolution, which is a kind of revolution, a capitalist revolution. It's not a non-capitalist revolution. Neoliberalism, according to academic analyses, really commences in around 1980 with Ronald Reagan's policies and Margaret Thatcher in the UK. Both of them adopt and implement similar policies. Well, my forthcoming book, called The Scourge of Neoliberalism, is an attempt to yet analyze what this is all about. I don't think that most of the current analyses are in the past. You know, there's been a lot written on neoliberalism are accurate for a number of reasons. One, they tend to focus mostly on what's called austerity, fiscal austerity. In other words, cutting of social programs. Well, yes, that's part of it, but by far not the whole picture. Or they focus on what's called privatization of public goods and selling off national industries and so forth to private businesses and investors. And that's part of it, but that's not enough of it. Or they say, well, neoliberalism is about market forces, a return relying on markets rather than government. Well, that's true so far as it means cuts in social spending, social programs, right? Turning in and privatizing government industries. You turn it over to markets, meaning you turn it over to capitalists. Okay. But at the same time, what you see is an increase in non-market activity under this period since Reagan Thatcher. You see growing government intervention in the economy on behalf of big businesses. So if you were to return to true markets, the government would get out of the business of subsidizing business. And that's exactly what it's been doing more intensely ever since the 1980s, by means of fiscal policy. You know, as you eliminate fiscal spending on programs, but you increase spending programs that benefit business directly, that subsidize their profits. Or the government reduces taxes for businesses and investors, or you get subsidization by the central bank. Chronic low long-term interest rates reduce the borrowing costs for businesses, not just loans, but issuing corporate debt, bonds and commercial paper and so forth, right? So, you know, it's not true that it's a return to markets as the dominant driver here. I think that's an error because, you know, where does this neoliberal theory originate? Well, in academia. You know, liberal refers to 18th century capitalism, where Adam Smith and others advocated, let the markets rule, you know. Well, why did Adam Smith do that? Well, because he was really critiquing and attacking his predecessor, mercantilists, that believed in intense government subsidization and assistance to businesses like the East India Company, Hudson Bay Company, and so forth. You know, that was the dominant pre-18th century, you might say, economic justification for government, the king being, deeply in bed with the capitalists who were beginning to spread around the world, and he was getting a cut of everything, right? Well, Adam Smith comes along, and Adam Smith says, no, you know, we should not have all this government intervention on behalf and partnership on behalf of traders and merchants, right? Get out of the way, government, and let the new entrepreneur, the new economic man do his thing and produce and sell without intervention. Well, that was liberalism, you see. On the political side, there were certain political interests in the British Parliament that were called liberals, who backed up that idea of more market, less government intervention, preventing economic growth, right, and more government participation in other ways. You know, just as a digression, there's a little bit of a misunderstanding of Adam Smith. You know, most of these libertarians and others that really admire Adam Smith probably never read Adam Smith, because if they did, they would see that he advocated all kinds of government intervention in the education, in building infrastructure, social programs on behalf of the poor. Adam Smith was not a total free marketer, but he was for free markets to the extent that government aristocracy, landed aristocracy, kings were partnering with business merchants and not really allowing the new man, the new economic man, the new capitalist to really produce things, you see. So that's where the idea of liberal comes from. The Liberal Party reflected those views on markets by Adam Smith. All right, so academics pick this up and they say, oh, neoliberal, the focus on markets. And what they see with Reagan and Thatcher is partly correct, that deregulation of industries, deregulation in the sense of eliminating social programs, deregulation in the sense of privatizing government industries and government companies and production and turning it over, selling it on pennies on a dollar to private interests, right? Deregulation. Those are all forms of deregulation. Deregulating prices, no price controls on how much banks can charge interest. You know, it used to be in the 1970s that there was a ceiling of 7% on credit cards. You know, that was nicely eliminated. And there used to be a ceiling on how much airlines can charge and how much utilities could charge and a whole number of areas in terms of prices. Well, that was all lifted. And, of course, prices eventually go through the roof with that lifting, which means more profits, you see. Okay, so deregulation is a big part of all this neoliberalism, and an academic theory grew up in the early 80s called efficient markets theory, which said that markets are always and everywhere more efficient than government. Well, this was an ideological justification that was made to support, legitimize the government privatizations and government eliminating of price controls and government reducing social spending. But spending by government in other ways intensified under, quote, neoliberalism. It intensified. So it's not true that neoliberalism is just about markets liberalization. In part it is, but in part it isn't. We see just the opposite. And it's not simply about austerity social program spending reductions or even about privatizations and deregulations. That's all part of it, but it's not the full picture. My view is that you have to understand neoliberalism on several dimensions. One, neoliberalism is about restructuring of the economy in response to an economic crisis. Two, it's a certain policy mix, policies meaning monetary, fiscal, industrial, and external trade and money flow policies. It's a certain combination that emerges in the 1980s that is different from previous periods. So it's about restructuring, and it's about a certain new policy mix, and it's about ideological justification of this restructuring and new policies, because the policies and the restructurings lead directly to increasing income and wealth inequality. So you got to justify this, you know. By ideology, I don't mean some ism here. I mean a conscious misrepresentation of reality on behalf of certain interests. Conscious misrepresentation. Extreme version of that, of course, is lying, but it's much more sophisticated than that. They use, economic ideology uses certain techniques and certain methods for changing the explanation of reality and the relationship between variables in the economy and so forth. For example, ideology. Neoliberal ideology. Some of the main propositions of neoliberal ideology are the following. And you've heard them all, but they've really become embedded since the 1980s. Actually, neoliberalism begins in the late 70s under Carter. But I'll talk about that in the book. All right, so neoliberalism as ideological justification is often overlooked by contemporary treatments of what is neoliberalism. Just as the restructuring that neoliberalism is really about, the economic restructuring, is overlooked. And even the broad policy mix is overlooked and focusing just on austerity, privatizations, and markets. Okay, so what are some of the ideological justifications? Well, here's some of them, and I have a chapter on this in the book. One, tax cuts. Business tax cuts create jobs. Business investor tax cuts create jobs. Well, we've heard that, haven't we, since Ronald Reagan. Every tax cut legislation in the United States would be called a Jobs Act. Second, free trade benefits all parties. Third, markets are more efficient. Well, we've talked about that one, right? Inequality is due to the lack of individual productivity contribution. In other words, if you're not making a lot of wage and a lot of income, it's your fault. You're not as productive. You're not contributing as much as you should. Go get an education and contribute. That's what that means. Inequality is due to individual productivity. Low interest rates determine investment. Central banks are independent of the government and the private banking interests. Well, in my recent book, Alexander Hamilton, Origins of the Fed, I take that on, as well as its sequel that I produced earlier in 2017, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, and various articles I've been writing for European Financial Review. In other words, just you can read them on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Central banks are not independent, not of the government and not of the banks. Another proposition, inflation is always too much money chasing too few goods. Another, we have crises because there's a global savings glut. And finally, recessions are due to external shocks to an economic system that is otherwise inherently, fundamentally stable. In other words, it's not caused by something inherent and endemic to it. It's caused by some external event. These are all ideological propositions of neoliberalism. In other words, they're used to justify the policies and the restructuring of neoliberalism. You know, used by the media, both the corporate media and the even more obvious, the lying of Fox News and the talking heads and so forth. Let's call it Trump's media, right? Trump's media and the anti-Trump media, right? They both perpetrate these ideas, these ideological misrepresentations of the relationship of variables that justify the policy mix. Right? What's the policy mix of neoliberalism? Well, on the monetary side, it's to provide excess liquidity, massive excess liquidity, pump money into the economy to keep interest rates long-term excessively low. This subsidizes business. as I've talked about in my central banker's book and articles, right? We've got monetary policy by central banks, subsidization of capital incomes going on big time now. Fiscal policy. What's part of the fiscal policy mix of neoliberalism? You know, monetary policy is subsidizing low interest rates long term. Fiscal policy is tax cuts for businesses and investors and shifting the burden of tax on the personal income tax from higher incomes to middle class incomes. Excess war and defense spending. Acceptance of higher government debt and financing. That's all part of fiscal policy neoliberalism. What about a third policy area, which I call industrial policy? Well, that's where deregulation and privatizations come in, but it's also about privatizing social programs and benefits like health care and pensions and so forth, and wage compression, and changing labor markets to emphasize contingent labor and part-time temp work, in other words, breaking the backs of unions and collective bargaining, which they've pretty much done, except in the public sector, maybe, right? That's industrial policy. That's part of neoliberalism as well. And then there's the fourth external policy, as I call it, which is about free trade and about the twin deficits, creating a deficit, a trade deficit, in order to get the money flowing back to the U.S. And allowing an increase in the national debt because the money flows that come back from the trade deficit finance the U.S. budget deficit. So this twin deficit idea and free trade and global money capital flows are all also part of the policy mix, the neoliberal policy mix. So it's monetary policy, fiscal policy, industrial policy, and external policy. And most accounts of neoliberalism don't understand the relationships between these policies. In my book, I describe the evolution of these policies from Reagan through Trump. Trump is an attempt to reestablish neoliberal policy mix, a new mix, more aggressive than before. Trump is restructuring the global economy, trying to anyway. So he's very much a neoliberal. And of course, the ideological justifications are rampant now for all of this restructuring and this new policy mix, all of which lead to more income inequality. Finally, neoliberalism requires political restructuring as well. It requires a suppression of democracy and civil liberties, changes in the political parties and who controls them. Also, it requires more money in politics. Citizens United and all of this, corporate finance and corporate personhood are all reflections of the political changes required to keep neoliberalism going. 30,000 lobbyists in Washington now, revolving doors and regulatory capture, the surveillance state, the growing role of NSA and others in imperial control of the U.S. You know, the U.S. has bases in 143 countries today. All of this is the political consequence. And in the book, I have chapters both on the ideological justifications of neoliberalism and on this political consequence, political restructuring, that also has to be viewed as a consequence in part of this neoliberalism. We keep using the term neoliberalism because that's what everyone understands it as. But, you know, I think neoliberalism as a term is a bit ideological itself because it obfuscates really what's going on, which is class warfare. Interclass warfare between capitalists and intra between capitalists and their domestic oppositions.